It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Gas and diesel prices are edging down ever so slightly after the Memorial Day weekend, but remain significantly higher than they were even just a month ago. That's according to AAA fuel prices data for Wisconsin.
Refinery issues here in the Midwest have intensified the disruption to oil supplies caused by the war in Iran, and prices are expected to remain elevated until the Strait of Hormuz reopens. That's a vital trading route for the world's oil supply.
In Wisconsin, the transportation industry has seen record-high diesel prices. In just a bit, we'll hear how the state's trucking industry is responding to that spike.
First, to find out where gas prices go from here, we turn to Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis for the fuel tracking site Gas Buddy. Patrick, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Gas prices, they were steadily increasing over the last few months. Why did we start to see them come down just a bit heading into the Memorial Day weekend?
Well, we've seen a bit of a lull, thankfully, both in gasoline, which average prices in Wisconsin down 14 cents a gallon, and the price of diesel, which is now nearly 22 cents lower than where it was back on May 13 when it was record-setting at 588, diesel down to 568. A lot of the decline in both gasoline and diesel prices comes after President Trump hinted last week that the U.S. was working on negotiations with Iran. That caused oil prices to start dropping as more signs emerged that that was correct. There's been more drop in the price of oil on hopes that there would be an eventual deal. Now, this morning, after new attacks, the U.S. Making some self-defensive attacks, Iran now promising retaliation, the oil market's still a little bit split. Oil prices for Brent crude oil this morning back up $4 a barrel, signaling that the market is worried about the next few days of what this looks like. But WTI crude oil, which expires nearly 3 weeks later, down $2.50 a barrel to $94 a barrel. That is telling you that the market is conflicted, that there is risk, but overall, the amount of dialogue happening back and forth is promising. Now, what that does to gas prices is prices may continue to drift lower for now, but if by later this week or early next week, there still isn't a deal, and if there are new escalations, well, then gasoline prices may eventually go right back up. But right now, the market positioning for a downward drop in prices, the continued decline in prices, at least for now, as we navigate what comes next, whether there will be a deal to reopen the strait or whether that falters.
Okay, so there's the geopolitical forces at work in the markets. We did know heading into the Memorial weekend, AAA projected a record 39 million Americans traveling by car. Did this demand from drivers have any impact on the prices at the pump?
Well, we didn't really see a record-setting amount of gasoline consumption, and it's far below record levels. So, you know, I don't know what vehicles, you know, the poll surveyed, but at least from our look, gasoline demand was quite a bit below record-setting levels, which could tell you one of two things. Either motorists are starting to respond to the fact that gas prices are still $1.31 above last year, or that people that may have intended to hit the road maybe stayed a little closer to home. It's a little early as we continue to tabulate gasoline demand over the weekend. As these information trickles in, we'll be able to have a better insight into whether or not those numbers from AAA were accurate or if they were just hopeful.
So the closure of Strait of Hormuz, that has hampered the world's oil supply. But what has been happening with refineries in the Midwest that have caused prices to go up higher?
Well, as we saw over the last few weeks, Wisconsin's gas prices about a month ago in late April started to ratchet up significantly compared to the national average. And that was due to refinery issues that developed about a month ago. Wisconsin's average was about 367. And then refinery issues at the same time maintenance was happening pushed prices up considerably higher. In fact, one moment last week, 2 weeks ago, the statewide average reached 459. Thankfully, those refining issues have been sorted out for the most part, and that has allowed prices across the state to decline 25 cents a gallon in the last 2 weeks. And that trend may continue, not only if oil prices continue to decline, but the refining issues have been sorted out, and that could create a little bit more downward momentum at the pump before we see what the next chapter may look like. And again, the next chapter is going to be more contingent on whether or not there is a deal with Iran to reopen the strait or not.
And when this next chapter comes, when the Strait of Hormuz eventually reopens and stays open, how quickly will we start to feel the relief on gas prices?
Well, given that we are already seeing some relief because of hopes of negotiations would be successful, the relief may either continue or it could abruptly shift. And what the price of oil does today generally will influence what you're paying at the pump in 2 to 3 days. Now, the difference here is that prices, if there is a clear reopening of the strait, would likely plunge rather quickly within a few days, or they would start declining. But it would take many, many months for gas prices to fall back to pre-war levels. In fact, it may take until 2027 to rebuild global oil inventories back to their pre-war levels. So some of those ultra-low sub-$3 prices may not reemerge until at some point and maybe as long as 2027 or beyond.
Patrick, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Patrick DeHaan is head of petroleum analysis for the fuel tracking site GasBuddy. Now for a look at how these high prices at the pump are affecting the transportation industry, we have Dan Johnson, president of the Wisconsin Motor Carriers Association. It's a nonprofit trade association representing about 1,000 members in the state. Dan, welcome back.
Hi, good morning, Kate. How are you?
I'm well. What is the level of panic or concern you're hearing from your members right now? What is it like out there?
Well, I think panic might be a bit of an overstatement. They're concerned. I mean, oil and gas prices affect the trucking industry just like they affect everybody else. But of course, in the trucking industry, it's a little bit more difficult to navigate some of the changes and some of the fluctuations in the market. There are opportunities and options that trucking companies can utilize either through fuel surcharges or negotiated contracts prior to any of these kind of fluctuations in oil prices. But, you know, they do have to make decisions. They have to make operational decisions. They have to look at different ways to navigate to find the most fuel efficient routes, perhaps. They do have to look at general costs of that are affecting their industry and their company from day to day and week to week. So there are a lot of things that they can do to sort of mitigate a lot of this. So I don't know that panic would be the right word, but they're concerned about this. We've been through this before about 5 years ago when diesel prices spiked near to where they are today. So it's not our first time through this, but definitely we would like to see some relief sooner rather than later.
How do higher diesel costs for the transportation industry, higher energy costs, how do they get passed down to the consumer?
I mean, it's basic economics. You know, the company, you know, they do pay these costs, or the shippers pay a little bit more with the fuel surcharges, and that is going to be passed along to the consumers in a couple of ways, either in a higher price that they pay for their goods, or perhaps there may be delays in getting those items shipped to them as they try to put a pause on their shipping operations and maybe wait things out, or again, just a straight increase to the consumer. So it's a complex situation, but at the same time, it's also pretty simple as to how the prices do get passed on. So we all feel it. We all have to make spending decisions as to, you know, what our consumer needs are going to be during the month. I mean, you know, we just came off of the Memorial Day weekend, which is like the traditional start of summer. So maybe people are thinking about what they're going to be doing for their summer travel, the kind of purchases that they're going to be making this summer as a part of those travel. I heard you mention, you know, maybe they're going to stay a little bit closer to home. That's certainly possible. While that may positively impact local economies, you know, nearby, those other economies, either statewide or in other parts of the country, might be feeling that impact.
How long can Wisconsin trucking companies continue to operate with rising diesel prices? Is there a breaking point?
You know, I don't know that there's necessarily a breaking point. There's obviously, we've seen spikes like this before after during the Ukraine-Russian war when that broke out a few years ago. They do have contingency plans in place to try to alleviate that, but I don't know that a sustained rise in diesel prices is going to be manageable, especially for our smaller trucking companies. The larger fleets, the mid-sized fleets, they can negotiate their contracts. They can add those fuel surcharges. They can get into fuel purchasing programs, which can lower the price at the pump. But the smaller operators, less than 10 power units, they're probably going to feel the impact a little bit greater because they're probably paying retail for diesel, if not close to retail. So they're probably feeling it the worst. And hopefully we get out of this within the next couple of 3 months.
You mentioned these fuel surcharges, trucking companies operating with fuel surcharge. So, their bottom line can stay relatively the same. How common is that, and why don't all companies do it that way?
Well, it is relatively common, like I mentioned, for the larger operators, the fleets that can negotiate with the fuel distributors. They're able to make those agreements between themselves. But again, the smaller operators, they quite frankly, they just don't have the fleet size to get into a large fleet program like that. If you have a couple, three trucks, or maybe five trucks, you may not be considered in that same universe for a fleet that could benefit from a fuel surcharge or some sort of negotiated contract. So, an owner operator with one truck, he or she is probably going to be paying close to retail price for diesel.
Do you anticipate any, with these smaller firms, would they go out of business at all? Would they merge with other small firms? Do you see any of those dynamics?
Well, you see those dynamics with a number of rising costs, whether it's labor, whether it's insurance, whether it's diesel. I mean, diesel fuel, it's 20 to 30% of their operating costs. So it's a significant part of their operating costs. And yeah, it's definitely going to affect them if they are paying that higher rate and they're not able to negotiate something. So it could definitely have a serious impact on their operations, perhaps with the freight recession and rising insurance costs. This might be the straw that breaks the camel's back for some of them. That's very, very possible.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Dan Johnson, president of the Wisconsin Motor Carriers Association, talking about rising diesel prices in the state.
Coming up, a national report shows an uptick in people going to church, but the growth isn't enough to reverse years of decline.
The big thing I would say to churches is don't allow either the narrative of decline or the narrative of resurgence to be an excuse to not to put the work in.
Wisconsin church leaders respond to the findings. That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Across the nation, the role of faith and religion in daily life is having a resurgence.
A recent report from the Hartford Institute for Religion Research found church attendance across the country increased for the first time in 25 years.
And a recent Gallup survey found 42% of young men say religion is very important to them. That's up nearly 15% from 2 years ago.
But researchers note the attendance growth is not enough to reverse years of declines in congregations across the country.
So, what are church leaders here in Wisconsin noticing in their communities?
Episcopal church leaders and a researcher join us for that discussion. Mother Amy Heimerl is the vicar of two Episcopal churches, Ascension in Merrill and St. Ambrose in Antigo. And Father Chris Corbin is the priest at Trinity Episcopal Church in Oshkosh. And Reverend Thomas Peach is an assistant professor of theology at Concordia University, Wisconsin, a Lutheran university in Mequon. Welcome to you all.
Thank you for having me.
It's my sincere pleasure to be here.
Hey, great to be here too.
Pastor Peach, let's start with you. And these recent findings on church attendance across the nation showing an increase for the first time in decades. What do you make of it?
Well, in some ways, it's not a complete surprise to see the data reflect what some of us have been experiencing anecdotally. And so it's a really interesting kind of phenomenon that's been going on for some years now, too, where younger people are returning to the church, perhaps in greater numbers than we would expect. There was a long period of decline in church attendance. And it's not to say that there's a huge numbers of revival among young adults necessarily, but some of the decline is just being checked a little bit. And we're seeing new faces in the pews. Pastors are getting new knocks on the door from people with very varied backgrounds as well. And so the data, in a way, I think reflects what people in the churches have been quietly observing for some time.
Father Chris in Oshkosh, what are you hearing from congregants who are returning to your church or attending for the first time?
I think that a similar phenomenon is happening. The rise I particularly can point to in young men's religiosity. That's actually been a pretty significant band that we've seen in terms of coming just to our church. We have been a congregation that has been growing, and that's a not insignificant part. But I think I've also just noticed a general return across age bands that is, I would echo, marked by this sense of a desire to connect with something deeper that is not being met in the community at large, or if not to connect with something deeper, a desire to have community in an increasingly isolating world. I think that that's also a pretty significant thing that is coming up. And religious communities, and that means especially, I think, in the United States, churches provide spaces for communal living that don't exist in almost any other place.
Interesting. Mother Amy, turning to you, leading two small congregations in Wisconsin, in Merrill and Antico, you know, rural communities can also be isolating on their own. They can also be very much community-oriented. You almost had to close the congregation in Antico because it had just 6 members. What has brought it back?
We had voted actually in October. We voted to close, but not until Easter Vigil. We would make that our final service because we wouldn't want to leave a church empty over the winter. And we said, okay, if nothing else changes, we will do this. And what happened was one person said, we can't do this anymore. And of course, at that moment, when we say we can't, that's when God says, I can, because that is really the only way anything actually gets done, in my belief, is when we finally surrender. But really what happened was we reluctantly said, okay, this is our reality. And then God said, no, I'm not doing that. And it was kind of a cute story. I was driving up to Rice Lake for a meeting, and my phone rang, and it was a number I didn't recognize. And of course, I don't answer numbers I don't recognize in this day and age. People can leave a message if they need me to call them back. And so I wasn't going to answer, but I heard this voice that said, answer the phone. And I argued and I said, no. And the voice again, answer the phone. And I said, no. And sternly, it was answer the phone. And fine, I'll answer the phone. And I answered, and it was a man who wanted to bring a ministry, use our church for a ministry. They had had an existing ministry in the city, but needed to leave the place where they were having that ministry due to just some things that the church they were in needed more space, et cetera. And I said, well, I can't make that decision on my own. You can come and talk to the congregation. And I didn't mention to him that we had just voted to close. And I said, you can come after our worship service. And he said, well, why don't I come for your worship service? I said, well, that's even better. And he came with his wife. They run the ministry together. They have started to bring friends. And the ministry is, it's called Starting Over, which is extremely relevant for our church, St. Ambrose in Antigo.
Father Chris, I understand you are conducting your own study on attendance in the Episcopal Church. What's come up so far? What do you want to look at?
To give some background, I had kind of just gotten tired of the constant barrage of news about the church declining. And when I say the church, I mean particularly the denomination, the Episcopal Church, because while that is true, And it is important for churches to be aware of the lived reality of the larger denomination. I also know about these churches that are growing, that have experienced new life, have experienced the coming together of spiritual and numerical vitality. And I had recently read Chip and Dan Heath's book, Switch, which talks about the importance of looking at bright spots. And rather than looking at what's failing and try to fix what's failing, you lift up what is working well and try to replicate that. And I'd gotten frustrated that that was not happening at a larger denominational level. So I finally said, okay, I guess I'm going to have to do it. So I began looking at bright spot churches, churches that had seen consistent growth or were at least stable from 2011 through 2023 and were able to actually weather and continue growing through that period. What came out of that initial survey, though, was that a lot of the things that were common to them looked like, to me, just background Episcopal churchness. Hmm. It looked like just the background denominational character. So that's what really led me to say, okay, I've got to actually do a census of the whole Episcopal Church. And so we are at a place where over 5,600, almost 5,700 churches have been offered the capacity to take part in this study. And we're beginning to get that data in, but we haven't analyzed it yet. But what I can say, just even looking at that first wave, some of the things that began to pop as at least hypotheticals, at least possibilities pushing forward to look at in this second wave of the survey are sort of unsurprisingly churches that are growing. They follow up with their newcomers. If someone shows up, someone at the church is going to follow up and say, hey, we're glad that you showed up. Hmm. They're not going to get sort of left on red, as it were, as a from the congregation. There's an investment in the quality of the worship, not necessarily the style. And that, I think, is important, is that it's not that this correlates to any particular style, but whatever style you do it well. And then there's a real strong emphasis on getting people into formation outside of the Sunday service. So one of the things that came up was something like the median percentage of adults who were involved in formation in these consistently growing churches was like 55% of Sunday attendance, which if you have a lot of young people, that may be really close to saying that all the adults who are showing up on Sunday are also taking part in some sort of formation. So,
and when you say formation, yeah, what do you mean by that?
Okay, so that could be an ongoing explicit sort of lecture class that's mm-hmm. put on, say, by the pastor or by another lay person in the congregation. That could be a small group that has a book study component. Uh-huh. That could be Sunday mornings. Let's have an adult forum between the services where we're going to talk about a different topic every week. But it's investing beyond just showing up on Sunday.
Okay. We are talking about church attendance in Wisconsin after national polls show signs of a resurgence. That is Father Chris Corbin there, priest at Trinity Episcopal Church in Oshkosh. We have Mother Amy Heimerl, the vicar of Ascension Episcopal in Merrill and St. Ambrose Episcopal in Antigo, and Reverend Thomas Peaches here, an assistant professor of theology at Concordia University. As we talk about involvement in the church, and as Father Chris is finding, you know, we're also seeing in these studies that volunteerism is up in churches from this recent report. There's more involvement showing, you know, like pre-pandemic levels. And I wonder, Pastor Peach, what do you make of that as an indication of the health of a community, of the health of a church?
Well, obviously, it's very encouraging to see people do some heavy lifting and volunteering around the parish. I think especially in my experience, one challenge for young people coming into the church is sometimes to translate their what they've seen online. They've been watching videos or listening to things about religiosity and spirituality, and to translate that into actual concrete liturgical practice. It's one thing to kind of intellectualize the faith or think that it's good for society or good for me in particular, but another thing to actually begin the life of love towards your neighbor, of confessing your sins and receiving the holy body and blood of Christ for forgiveness, and praising God and doing these other practices. And one of the things this data shows is the encouraging way in which people are, for better and for worse in some situations, translating what begins as more of a perhaps online directed impulse that I need to, having watched Jordan Peterson videos or something like this, attend my local church, but then to translate that into an actual embodied participation in the holy things of God too.
Hmm. Mother Amy, I understand you have a presence on social media and have become more known in the community because of that. Is this part of how church leaders need to adapt to find new ways to reach people?
Well, I just want to clarify about my online presence. We, at both of my churches, we are not online. We don't stream. We don't interact online at the church. But what I do is every day, except Fridays, I do an online, just a Facebook Live, whether it is a short scripture reading with a few of my thoughts about it, or just leading prayer, and just try to make a daily presence where people can kind of get a taste for maybe what they will hear, or what, you know, to reflect the theology that, so they kind of know what they would be stepping into. So what happens oftentimes is I'll be in the community and somebody will say, "Oh, hey, you're Amy, you're Mother Amy. I've watched you online," or "Or hey, aren't you that pastor who works with special needs people and does a special needs service?" Or aren't you, you know, I'll get questions or be recognized in the community. And it's always surprising and humbling to know that, you know, that people are tuning in and people are listening. And I think it also, you know, there are some people who are not as, who have very different views, I guess, than I would have, that it can kind of help them decide maybe what they also don't want. Yet on the other hand, I would consider at least my church in Merrill a very purple church. And we, you know, despite whatever it is that I say, maybe that they agree or disagree with, we still love each other and come together as community. You know, whether we agree on politics or we agree on things or not. So, yeah, that presence is more of from my personal page. I share it to my church pages. But as far as the church goes, the services, they are in person. And I feel like that's where we need to be right now, is only in person.
Father Chris, I want to land with you here. You know, as we look at this report on church attendance and whether it's a blip or a sign of recovery and renewal for churches, you're in conversation with so many churches. I'm wondering, is there skepticism out there, or is there optimism at this point?
I think there is both. So I'm perhaps a little bit too online as sort of my personal identity on. So Blue Sky is one of the big places I'm on, and I definitely see everyone kind of posting reports about increases in religiosity in a way that really fits their confirmation bias. So the folks who want there to be a revival are really excited by the data, and the people who maybe don't or are sort of dispositionally pessimist will post sort of saying, yeah, but you still have to remember that this doesn't negate the larger generational trends that we're seeing. And I think you have to actually hold both of those things together. That it is true that Gen Z is the most unreligious generation in America right now. That is true. And that the fact that some of these more, and especially more traditional and more theologically and sometimes socially conservative denominations do seem to be increasing. And sometimes if you look in isolation, say at the increases in Orthodox worship attendance, they can be astounding, but you still have to hold that number over and against the larger background of religious disaffiliation or non-religiosity in the United States. So the big thing I would say to churches is don't allow either the narrative decline or the narrative of resurgence to be an excuse to not to put the work in. I think that is really what people are often looking for, is to say these are larger trends that we have no control over. And so we can be optimistic if there is a larger trend towards resurgence, because that means our church will grow again and we don't really have to do anything to make that happen. Or the reason our church is declining is because people just aren't going to church anymore. And so it's really not our fault. We don't really have any agency, but that means we also don't have any responsibility. And I think that churches can find a kind of comfort in that. But I would push back and say,
don't get caught up in the narrative.
Exactly. Yeah. That what matters is your individual congregation doing what it needs to reach out to and proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ in the community around you, and also to not make sort of unforced errors.
Well, thank you so much for exploring this topic and for this conversation, Father Chris, Pastor Peach, and Mother Amy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for having me.
It was absolutely my pleasure.
That is Mother Amy Heimerl, vicar of two Episcopal churches, Ascension in Merrill and St. Ambrose in Antigo, Father Chris Corbin, priest at the Trinity Episcopal Church in Oshkosh, and Reverend Thomas Peach, an assistant professor of theology at Concordia University, Wisconsin. They responded to a recent report that found for the first time in two decades, church attendance is up in the U.S. and what this looks like for congregations here in Wisconsin.
Coming up, the first Hmong families arrived in Eau Claire a half century ago. A new documentary features their stories of making a life in the Chippewa Valley.
The basis of what I thought I knew about Hmong people and my neighbors in the community, frankly, was mostly incorrect.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Verrett. During the Vietnam War, the CIA recruited tens of thousands of Hmong boys and men to serve as proxy soldiers in what later became known as the Secret War.
Many Hmong people lost their lives in the war, while others fled for safety, making a dangerous swim across the Mekong River to escape to refugee camps in Thailand.
From there, more than 100,000 Hmong people were resettled throughout the United States, including in Wisconsin. The first Hmong families arrived in Eau Claire in 1976, 50 years ago this year.
To commemorate the anniversary, the staff at a multimedia company in Eau Claire created a documentary film featuring the stories of local Hmong refugees who made a life for themselves in the Chippewa Valley.
McKenna Shear is the managing editor, and Alex Barber is video and photo director for Volume 1 in Eau Claire. They're the filmmakers behind A Half Century Home, 50 years of Hmong resettlement in Eau Claire. And Chong Chang He is a retired pastor and owner of Hmong American Insurance Services in Eau Claire. He's one of the storytellers in the film. They joined us last week from WPR's Eau Claire studio. McKenna, take us back 50 years to the beginning of this story when Hmong people first started coming to Eau Claire. You saw there's a lot of misunderstanding among the local culture over who these people were. What did you learn in doing this documentary about the first Hmong families who called Eau Claire home?
I learned so much, and I preface that a bit with saying that I grew up in Eau Claire. I was born in Chippewa Falls. I grew up in Eau Claire. I went through the school district here, graduated from high school here before I went to college in another state. I mention that because the basis of what I thought I knew about Hmong people and my neighbors in the community, frankly, was mostly incorrect. And I think that that is a bit parallel with maybe what folks knew about the Vietnam War during the time. You were served a particular picture of the Vietnam War. And in, oh my gosh, I don't know, dozens and dozens of newspaper clips and radio recordings that I listened to or read, there was little or zero mention of the word Hmong. People were referring to folks as Vietnamese or Thai, because I think that even reporters who may have been potentially on the ground or were specifically reporting on the war, they did not know about the Hmong people. They did not know about the culture, and they largely did not know about the secret war either. So I think what I really learned through that history was, even to today, even to when I was going to school in Eau Claire 15, 20 years ago, we still weren't directly saying those words or exploring that specific history. The goal here for me and for us was to attempt to condense a 50-year history, not possible, but to attempt to do so based on talking to people in real life who actually are our neighbors and live here and lived this, and then parse together that educational history and true history together into one place that hopefully is accessible for people in a free, accessible way.
And before we meet one of those neighbors, Alex, I want to hear from you as the video director at Volume One. What was your approach to taking these modern day interviews, that archival material that McKenna was just talking about, and putting that all together to tell the visual story here?
Yeah, I think what became immediately apparent is that we needed to hear the story directly from people. So not having so much overhead with video production, not trying to make it flashy or fancy, we just want to hear directly from people what they have to say about the situation, which usually meant that we would go to a place that was familiar to people we're interviewing. So houses, businesses, grocery stores, any place that people would feel comfortable, and we would just talk. We'd talk for upwards of, one of our interviews lasted for almost 3 hours, which also was being translated in real time as well. We wanted to hear people's story directly using the Hmong language. We ended up getting a lot of footage from people that we had talked to, but even more footage and pictures and stuff was just so hard to access. We talked to a lot of people in the community who had even said, you know, we didn't think that this film or this tape that we had would be relevant anymore, so we threw it away. We didn't keep it. So a lot of people's history and family life growing up, for many people, is gone. That also led us to reach out to a lot of universities. I had reached out to some people in Laos and Thailand to try to get some more pictures and some more information. We actually ended up working with a professor from UW-Madison who graciously allowed us to use an entire collection of over 8,000 images that they had to help tell that story of resettlement, of having to escape Laos to Thailand and then Thailand to the U.S.
I want to bring Chong into it now. Chong, you share your story in the documentary. You came to the United States by yourself when you were 18, first in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and then eventually in Eau Claire. You'd been through this horrible, traumatic experience, arrived in this new place by yourself. What are your first memories of arriving in the Midwest?
Back in our country, we don't have it as snow. I think in April 24, when I first came to America, and I see snow, and it's very cold, even though in April still very cold, but I'm not prepared for it, you know. So that is the first thing, and it's still in my mind today. And we see a lot of, especially one of my cousins told me that when I came to Fort Wayne, and then immediately right after that, they left to Iowa. Left me alone. And he told me that he gave me a dime, a nickel, I think. And he said, if you need a taxi or a drink, you just go to here and you drop the coin through here, and then the taxi will be coming. And I never thought that going to happen, you know, until I try. So those two things that still on my mind today.
At one point, Chong, in the documentary, you talk about how it's important for Hmong people to learn about this history. Why was that so important for you?
Well, because the younger generation, I call them is the lost generation, because they really don't know who they are and where they are coming from. And most of them, they just thought that it just happened here. So they happened just be here, you know, but they don't know the history that their parents struggled through in the past. So that's why it's very important. I usually tell them, the younger generation, that they need to know who they are and where they are coming from. So if you don't know your history, you will not be able to, you know, to live in the present time. And if you don't know your present time, you will not be able to prepare for future. So that is very important to know who you are and where you're coming from. So that is very important, yeah.
We're talking about a new documentary film called A Half Century Home, 50 Years of Hmong Resettlement in Eau Claire. Chong Chang-her, retired pastor, he shares his story in the documentary. We also have the filmmakers, McKenna Shear and Alex Barber from Volume 1. McKenna, talking to people, as you mentioned, in their homes and in other comfortable spaces, they shared really powerful stories. Tears, both of coming here, the flight from Laos, bullying and beatings in Eau Claire. What was it like to have people bearing their souls in some ways, in ways maybe they aren't used to doing?
Absolutely. I think, firstly, I'd like to say that we also laughed a lot during these interviews and at events that we went to hang out with families and people. There was so much, as I mentioned before, going in that I thought I knew, or preconceptions that I did not know that I had until I'm sitting with people and having conversations. And some of those things include, like you said, my only focusing on what I thought were going to be horrible stories, true stories, painful stories. And while that's true, and that's vital and important to understanding that history and understanding our neighbors, you have to acknowledge the joy and the success and the laughter of our Hmong neighbors. I mean, I've laughed so much with everybody. And so I wanted to say that first and foremost. Of course, as Alex mentioned, our interviews generally range between 1.5 to 3+ hours. They were in person with folks. I think all of them were, including with some kiddos. And that looked like me asking questions, I think, that maybe the average person wouldn't want to ask, that maybe aren't uncomfortable, and that is a barrier to understanding each other, right? You don't want to make somebody uncomfortable, or you feel too uncomfortable to ask questions. What I did was try to ask the questions that felt open-ended enough to just start a conversation. A great example of that is when we chatted with Blia Schwan. I think I asked her one question, and then she told me 45 minutes worth. She walked me through these different chapters of her life.
I always tell people that I feel like I've lived like 3 different lifetimes, just because Laos was so different, and then Thailand was very different, and then coming here to the U.S. was very different.
People just want to be asked, I think. I think people just want somebody to care enough to ask. I think everybody can relate to that in some way. But that's another big takeaway I had.
Chong, the documentary ends with a message that, you know, Hmong people, they've built a community in Eau Claire and the surrounding area, but they're also part of the Eau Claire community. They're neighbors. Can you talk a little bit about how you feel now, so many decades later, living in Eau Claire as part of that community?
Yes, because we came to America as a refugee, meaning that we will never go back, or we don't have any other way. So when we came to America, I usually tell people that we are here, and that we'll stay here, and we'll be here. So we need to have an education so we can help, you know, support the city where we live in. And we need to be a good citizen and to help the city. and then also the state and also the federal level. And in order to do that, we need to be a good citizen, you know, work hard and support yourself and support your community. So I'm so proud to be in Eau Claire here, especially the Chippewa Valley here, because we have a lot of people here that, like I said, after the, you know, we've been here for a long time, and I think we've been knowing each other, so we've been helping each other. So I think, yeah, we are here to stay, and we'll never have anywhere to go. So we need to be a good citizen and support ourselves in helping the community.
Alex, the documentary now has been out in the world for a few weeks. What kind of response have you gotten from viewers in Eau Claire and from the Hmong community so far?
Yeah, I think overall the response has been incredible. We've had tons of people send us emails, come into our offices and say, you know, thank you so much for doing this. We had no idea this was part of our history. We've heard a lot from the Hmong community as well that this seems to be touching younger generations, that people are interested in wanting to learn more. And then also, too, that for many people that have been in the situation like Dr. Herr had been in, where you deal with a traumatic event, it's very hard for people to open up and talk about those things. And along with some other events that have happened in the community, this documentary has also helped to start some of those conversations with people that the younger generation is asking their grandparents, you know, did this happen to you? Tell me your story. It's something that, you know, starting out in this project, we had no idea. Like McKenna said, we had no idea what we were getting into. But I think in a very positive way, we also had no idea how positive the response would be and how much people were wanting to hear this story, to see their stories and lives be put up on screen and to be understood, not just in Eau Claire, but I think, you know, nationally as well.
And Chung, has this documentary, being part of it and watching it, has this helped start conversations maybe with younger Hmong people in Eau Claire?
Yes, the majority of the young people, they still don't understand. So they have to learn from the beginning because, like I said, when they grow up here, you know, they thought they're just happened to be here, but they never know the history. So, yeah, a lot of people, they talking to me, they say, yeah, we wish we know, you know, earlier. So I think everybody, especially the younger generation, is something new for them too. So hopefully they will take those and, you know who they are and especially appreciate the parents what they did in the past.
That's a great place to leave it. Chung, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Alex and McKenna, thanks for sharing this documentary with us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That was McKenna Shear, Managing Editor of Volume 1, and Alex Barber, Video and Photo Director for Volume 1, and Chung Chang-Her, retired pastor based in Eau Claire. We've been talking about the new documentary film from Volume 1. It's called A Half Century Home, 50 Years of Hmong Resettlement in Eau Claire. It's available to watch for free at volume1.org, and the film includes Hmong subtitles.
Earlier in the show, we heard from Wisconsin church leaders about what to make of a resurgence of people who are attending worship services.
And we want to hear about what you notice happening in your spiritual community.
Is your congregation seeing growth? Do you see new faces at services and events? Or is your church community going through a difficult time with fewer people taking an active role?
How about volunteerism and outreach in your church community? Are there more helping hands, or is the need too great for what your congregation can offer?
Share your story about what's going on in your religious community, what you notice. Email Wisconsin Today at WPR.org. That's Wisconsin Today at WPR.org.
You can also call or text us at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Mackenzie Crummy, and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.